It's Thursday, New York City. It's the Progressive Radio Network. My name is Mark Farrell. How you doing? June is here. That long, cold spring we had on the East Coast has finally disappeared. We actually had some temperatures in the 80s, knocking on the 90s door. And you know it's summer, or actually the unofficial start of summer, when you walk around New York City on a Friday and majority of the people are toting bags around their shoulders, pulling those roly-polies because they are fleeing Dodge for the weekend. That's a telltale sign that the warmer temperatures are here because they're going to be jumping on buses, subways, to head to the Jersey Shore, Long Island, the Hamptons, etc. It's a great feeling. Love it. And of course, it's always kind of fun to check out all the beautiful New York City women. We've got a great show for you guys today. Packed show. We're hoping to hear from a woman who's actually walking 80 miles and to raise awareness on mental health. And that is not only what she's doing. Listen carefully. She's pulling a casket. Yes, you heard me correct. A casket, which actually is filled with food and water for herself. So it's not even a light casket. It's kind of heavy. She's walking from her town in New Jersey, 80 miles to the capital of New Jersey, Trenton, New Jersey, to raise awareness, to go to the Capitol building and say, listen, I am tired of teenagers and adults running the spectrum, dying by suicide. And we're hoping to hear from her. She's actually walking right now. Our producer, Jesse, is hot on her, trying to get her on the phone live. And we understand if she can't, but we still certainly would love to hear just a few words from her because it's just a really compelling thing that she's doing. And it's like the show of walks. Of course, with the springtime in New York City, there's a hemophilia walk. We're going to hear from Melissa Penn, who also was the co-founder of Happy Fest. And we had her and her husband on, Adam Stengel, a couple weeks ago. And we're going to talk about the success of Happy Fest and also her hemophilia walk in New York City this weekend. And Greta Schwartz is the woman I was talking to momentarily about the walk, the casket walk, we'll call it, or the casket pull. Maybe that's a new reality sport. Anyway, we're hoping to hear from her. If we don't, we have a lot of other things. First, I want to mention to you about something that's happening in North Carolina. Skinny jeans and bullying. A student is wearing skinny jeans and has been told she can no longer wear skinny jeans because that is the reason why she's being bullied. And of course, the student said, you cannot tell me what to do. And they're actually considering mandating that you cannot wear jeans, skinny jeans, or leggings, etc., because they think it taunts bullying. Well, you know what? I don't think that is the problem. That is not the problem by any stretch of the imagination. It is the bullying epidemic, and we have to teach students resiliency, to be determined, obviously, to counter bullies on many, many levels. Because, you know what? Bullies are just, they're knuckleheads, and they do that for many, many reasons, torment people, tease people. And it's not just because they were bullied themselves, et cetera. There's evidence that says that's not only the case, or they could actually have a very positive and loving environment at home, and they still can be bullies. So I don't think the dress code being altered that students cannot or be prohibited from wearing skinny jeans or tights or leggings, et cetera, is going to solve the epidemic in North Carolina. But a school member said that the proposed ban on skinny jeans and leggings started after a larger student was bullied while wearing them. The teacher suggested that she was wearing longer top, and the student replied, you can't tell me what to do because it's not in the dress code. So hence why they're revisiting the dress code at the New Hanover Country School in North Carolina. Again, bullying is an epidemic. It's something that's not going to go away. And I don't say that when I speak to audiences because people don't want to hear that. But the reality is people are not always kind. They're mean. They're wired. We are wired actually to be, you know, kind of reactive. But certainly in this day and age in society, we don't want to torment people. Certainly with words and with physical means. But unfortunately, some people think, and even adults think, that's still the only way to resolve problems or to demonstrate how strong of a personality is their personality is or may not be, because they're making up for other pitfalls in their life like lack of self-esteem, confidence, etc. And as a matter of fact, yesterday I had a great talk at a school in North Jersey. I spoke to just about 1,000 kids on mental health and drugs and alcohol. Incredible school. And just a footnote about this, that they actually had a police officer on the campus because they have a full-time police officer, not because it's unsafe inside the school, but they're trying to keep anyone from entering this school, obviously with all the events that have transpired in the last, 5-7 years that are unthinkable. But this gentleman actually raised the money to have me come in and speak because he's the head of an alliance or part of an alliance that actually raises critical funds to have talks such as myself. And it's very, very interesting to see and hear and feel the interest from all these kids who are just so, so interested in the stories that I was able to lend them, impart on them about, you know, things I experienced with mental health. And of course, I didn't ask to have anxiety, depression, or panic attacks, but I did bring on certainly the self-infliction of alcohol, cocaine, pot, etc. But their reactions to stories and their interests, and more importantly, their questions were just very profound. It's not like, you know, you get a few ridiculous questions here and there. And of course, I expect that at every talk. But I'd say out of the 12, 18 questions or so I fielded, about 8 or 10 of them were really good. And about 3 of them were questions, unique questions that I was never asked before. And unfortunately, I would like to tell you these questions, but in a live setting, sometimes I can't recall because, you know, your mind is going in like 5 different directions. I'm thinking about the question. I'm composing my answer very quickly, and I'm moving forward and working the room. And in a room sizable auditorium where there's almost 1,000 people, there's a lot going on. So unfortunately, I can't tell you how profound those questions were because I can't recite them. But the reality is it was really, really good. So the fact is bullying is something that, you know, we have to deal with. We have to tolerate. We have laws against it, just like we have seatbelt laws. Laws for smoke detectors that keep people safe. And of course, teachers, principals, faculty, and staff are all on the lookout for bullying. And I brought this up yesterday because one of the things I did when I was younger to make up for my visual impairment was the use of drugs and alcohol. And then once I resorted to bullying, thinking that would maybe make me a little bit more widely accepted. And wrong, mistake. And of course, I still carry the guilt around nowadays, even though it was a long, long time ago. I apologize profusely to Jerry, the gentleman that I bullied. And it's long, long, long water under the bridge for him, but not for me. And one of the reasons why I do what I do, to spread the importance of, you know, how that behavior is so ignorant and not tolerated on any level. So again, with Mental Health Awareness Month just passing in May, the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention is having a walk. Now, they have community walks, which are really cool, all across the country. Then they have 2 major walks that happen twice in the year, usually in the summer months. And I did the first one that they had in 2002 in Washington, D.C. It was incredible. It really was an incredible event, one of the most incredible events I've partaken in terms of sort of athletic endeavor / higher meaning event. Does that make sense? Yeah, definitely. Because it was really cool. First one of its kind anywhere on this globe. And it was in Washington, as I said. And it started out actually in Virginia. And we had to walk 26 miles. And it would end the next morning. It started on a Saturday and ended the next morning at sunrise at the Washington Monument. So the name of the events are called Out of the Darkness Overnight Walk. So obviously a giant metaphor. Darkness, depression. Light, healthy. You overcome your depression, whatever the mental health illness is. So I really grasped and really took a liking to the model that they took on. And so the first one had thousands of people. I didn't know what to expect. 26 miles, I've run a few marathons. Wasn't really too concerned about holding up. And I did quite well, felt good, just kept stretching out throughout the walk. But more importantly, much more importantly, was the people that I met. You know, you're walking through some suburbs. You're walking through the streets of D.C. at, you know, 2, 3, 4, 5 o'clock in the morning. And sometimes there's a stretch where there's just a few people with you or you're with a crowd. And you get to talk to some individuals from all across the country and sometimes from different parts of the world. And you really open up. I mean, there's nothing like, you know, meeting a stranger and kind of like opening up. And of course, someone who's there for a walk on mental health to raise critical funds for the prevention of suicide, education, research, etc., are there, obviously, you know, to do something a very valued measure. So the stories that I were exchanging with people and the bonds, and it was just really, really heartfelt. I mean, you know, you're walking, it's 3 o'clock in the morning, and I walked by myself, and I was kind of like, oh, well, you know, I don't have anybody to walk with, but it was never a problem because I would just go from one group to the next, or sometimes when I was alone for an hour or, you know, a couple hours cumulatively over the walk, it was fine because, you know, I got to reflect about my brother and just think about the overall, you know, powerful statement the walk is making. I mean, the friendships, the bonds, you know, it was palpable, really palpable. As a matter of fact, I stayed friends for a little while with a few people that I met. But it's just kind of really neat, the kinship that is created by hearing what I think is, you know, a very, very sad story, certainly, of my brother Mike dying by suicide in 1992. And then you hear other stories, and they're all equally sad. But the upside of it is that they're there either by relationship of, you know, a parent, a sibling, spouse, coworker, colleague, or maybe just because they've been touched by it themselves. Maybe they are suffering or have suffered from some sort of mental health illness. But the reason why they're there is to empower the movement and to create change, which I think is incredible on multiple levels. But to hear these stories that people open up so candidly and share, I mean, I think it's just incredible. That's one of the main reasons I do it because, yeah, sure, it's great, the synergy. Like, okay, so this Saturday's walk is starting at the Intrepid Sea, Air, and Space Museum on the west side in, I think it's like 44th or something like that. So that's an incredible statement right there. The name Intrepid alone, fearlessness, you know, just sets the tone. So they're going to have a great, great walk that kicks off from there. It's going to be 18 miles. I don't know the exact walk, but when we have Dr. Christine Motier, Chief Medical Officer of the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, join us in a few minutes, she will tell us a little bit more about that. But it's going to go around the tip of Manhattan. And what I'm really, really excited for is it's going to cross the Brooklyn Bridge. And I'm kind of embarrassed to say that I've never walked across the Brooklyn Bridge. Jesse, my producer, is looking at me like I'm crazy. I've never done it, Jesse. Probably one of the few New Yorkers that haven't. I've ridden across it. I've run across it, but I've never walked across it. So I think that's different. Because when you walk across something, you really get a whole different vibe and feeling for it, especially at night when the city's aglow and it comes alive in a different sense. You know, the city, every city has a different vibe when it comes alive at night. So it's going to be really cool. So it's going to be taking and snaking across the streets of New York City. So I'm really excited about this. Unfortunately, I'm doing the walk again because of my unfortunate wife who didn't have time to train 16 miles. You know, you can't really, for the average person, just strap on sneakers and walk 18 miles because, you know, you will get cramps and sore. And if you don't have the right sneakers and you're not conditioned to wear those sneakers, which, of course, I'm going to be wearing new sneakers and I'm supposed to wear them today to start getting some, you know, to break them in a little bit, which I haven't. But anyway, I will be indestructible and I will be indomitable and I will do the walk without a problem. And, of course, I have to raise money because this is all what it's about, raising money for research. And I have a lofty goal that Dr. Motier is going to be talking to us about in a few minutes. So the reason why I bring this to your attention is because things of this caliber, things of events, like persons like Ronald Reagan, they brought attention to Alzheimer's disease. Before that, Alzheimer's wasn't getting the recognition because certainly there was less information back then, I'd say in 95-ish. 90, 95-ish and between. Certainly we've grown a great deal in the area in terms of research and science. We can actually have medication that actually slows down the degeneration of the brain. But my specific point is that when you have a person, a public figure, that brings attention to a matter, it's phenomenal. And that's why American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, AFSP, does such great work because, you know, hey, depression, anxiety is rampant, rampant. And there's a lot of people who are very well-known public figures, celebrity stars, et cetera, politicians. As a matter of fact, Greta Schwartz, the woman I was telling you about, who's walking across a portion of New Jersey, pulling a casket, who's going to be ending up in Trenton today, was inspired by one of the Kennedys after he spoke at Stockton College on mental health a couple months ago. So it's just amazing how imparting information and wanting to do something. And as Greta Schwartz says, you know, she's not a doctor. She doesn't have any initials after her name, but she is tired of not being able to do anything. And enough is enough. She says, as a mother, I want to do something. As a matter of fact, yesterday, and most times when I speak, listen, I speak to audiences. I say to them, listen, I don't have any initials after my name. I don't have any advanced degrees besides BA in communications, which has nothing to do with alcohol and drugs and adversity, et cetera. But my life experiences make me an expert in me. Mark Farrell is an expert in Mark Farrell. And I tell these kids yesterday on the topic of mental health that you have to be an expert in you. You can have 10 of the best doctors in the world, and they can take MRIs, CAT scans, x-rays, et cetera, and tell you what's wrong internally. But they can't tell you how you feel compared to how you felt a month ago, 5 years ago, and how you can get healthy. It's very, very significant to realize the importance of being a true detective of yourself. Because if you can't kind of pinpoint how you feel, then how is anyone else going to realize how you feel as well? So it's imperative for that to happen. So the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention does great work. And I'm really, really happy to partake in this Saturday's walk. Now, if you still live in the area and in the New York City area, tri-state area, and want to become part of this, log on to AFSP.org, American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, AFSP.org, and you can still sign up. You have to raise $1,000, but they're very, very lax about the timeline. They give you about a month or so, and then they'll only charge your credit card like $5 million. You know, it's kind of worth it, right? It's a tax write-off. $5 million, you can recoup the loss in like a couple lifetimes. Not bad, right? In this day and age, in this financial landscape, that's not bad. So if you just joined us, the show is Insight. My name is Mark Farrell. It's a great Thursday. I call it Friday Eve. This number is 888-888-874-4888, 888-874-4888. And we're talking about mental health. I know Mental Health Illness Month was last month, May. But we're talking about it because there are a lot of events that are going on a national level, local level, and especially the conversation never really kind of reduces, because the more we hear about it, especially teenagers, the loss of any life is just really sad and disheartening. But the fact that is when you lose a teenager, it's even more so. It breaks my heart that such a young and precious life is lost when there's so much possible medical assistance, professionals, and family members and friends. As a matter of fact, one of the things I stressed yesterday during my talk to these thousand or so kids on mental health, mental illness, is that sometimes when people have depression, they have such blinders on, and understandably, that they think they're actually doing family members and friends a favor by saying to themselves, well, you know what, if I'm not here, I'm not going to cause anyone else pain. And actually, that one of the most inaccurate statements anyone with depression could possibly think or say to themselves, because the wake of the reality is that everyone who else, family members, friends, etc., survivors, are just going to have to live a life of sort of pain and sorrow and being totally missing that person for the rest of their life. And it's sad. And I understand, having depression myself, how, you know, people can think that. But what happens is it just gets transferred. That pain that person has just gets transferred to all the people touched by that person's life. And that's not really, you know, putting an end to anything on that matter. So again, if you just joined us, we're talking about Mental Health Awareness Month. That was in June. Yes, I know we flipped the calendar the other day. I got bad eyes, but they're not that bad. I know it's June, and I'm happy it's June 2nd. Yay! And I'm getting ready for this Saturday's walk in New York City. The American Foundation for Suicide Prevention is out of the Darkness Overnight Walk, which is happening here right in New York City. And, of course, we would have to have someone from the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention on to talk about this stellar event. And joining me right now is Dr. Christine Motier, Chief Medical Officer. Christine, Dr. Christine, can I call you Dr. Christine?
Of course you can.
How are you?
I'm great. Looking forward to the walk and so glad you'll be there.
Okay, I have to confess, I think I'm taking this quite personally. This is the second time you're on a show and you're not coming into the studio. Is it something as that? Come on. It's fun when you're in the studio.
Next time, Mark, we'll do it.
Okay, so now listen, are you going to be doing any of these miles with me, or are you just going to be just telling people important information on a very cool ship?
There are going to be all kinds of really cool things going on that day. The opening ceremony at 7 p.m., even if you're not walking in the walk, it's worth coming to see it. It's right at the Intrepid. From 4 to 6, I'll be doing an interactive session in the Intrepid auditorium, showing some videos and taking questions from the audience. The whole event, as you know, is so filled with just empowerment, I would say is the word. It's a sense of raising awareness and joining together with so many people, that sense of how many people are affected by mental health issues and suicide struggles and loss is just, you got to be there to experience it, to really fully understand. But I think it's one of the game changers that's going on in the field of suicide prevention right now.
Absolutely. And what I love about it the most is that it's an event that's not a dark event. It's a lively event. It's you can feel the synergy in the air. It's palpable. And people are there from varying relationships. And again, sometimes people are just touched by it because maybe they experience mental illness to some degree, or the fact that they just realize that sometime in their life, the chances of them experiencing mental illness is very probable.
That's exactly it. I mean, you know, I think what's happening in our society now as a whole is there's this really great window of opportunity. I hope it's not a short-lasting window. I don't think it will be, where people are realizing that mental health is just simply a fact. It's a part of health, part of the human condition, and we're all going to face life challenges at different times in our life. Sometimes that dips into really impacting our mental health in a way that we need to be more proactive and aware of. I love what you were saying earlier, Mark, about be an expert of yourself. Know how you work and how you tick, what makes you your best and what tends to bring you down. And we don't need to be, you know, with our head in the sand about that anymore.
It's so true. And I think we all take it so personally. When I addressed this audience yesterday, I said to them that I'm so candid about my depression and anxiety that I experienced a couple years ago. Anxiety is going to be a part of my life for my entire life. But when I went through it 15 years ago or so, that I didn't tell a soul except for my family, because I was just so in the thick of it that it was very hard for me to just, you know, get through a day, even though I was determined and it propelled me forward. And I was determined to just, I called it like my inner demon, to beat my inner demon. And then someone asked me in a crowd, they're like, well, why are you talking about it nowadays? And I said, because I realized the importance of sharing my story, because I learned a great deal. Not that I was embarrassed by it. More importantly, I was just so self-absorbed. And I don't mean that in a way, as you know, and for our listeners, not because it was so overwhelming just to get through a day and go to work and fake it, put that mask on, conduct interviews on the radio live, you know, when I'm freaking out. But that's what I did. But my job is right now to impart my experience and just to let people know that, listen, just like if I walked out of here right now or tripped in the elevator and broke my tooth, where am I going to go? I'm going to go to the dentist. It's just a no-brainer in terms of, you know, getting addressed the issue that you're having, and that you have to know yourself. And listen, you can't be happy all the time. Nobody expects it, because there's a lot in life that can get you down. But it's just when things happen on a prolonged basis.
Yeah, that is so right. And it is so important to talk about these things. You know, and what you're saying is right on. When you're in the throes of distress, whether it's anxiety or depression or addiction, and when it's really intense, it does consume you. It does take, you know, every ounce of effort to kind of muster up to just sort of keep going. And yet, and so it goes against your instincts to reach out, to talk about what's going on in that moment, but it's so important to connect with at least one trusted person and ideally a professional who can help you get through that time. And then to talk about it, because that takes the stigma out of it for other people who are either going through it now or have yet to face that. But it is so commonplace that there simply should be no shame in it. And it is a health issue. We don't feel ashamed of other kinds of health issues.
Absolutely. And I was happy to hear and see, more importantly, that yesterday two kids actually came up to me, teenagers, they were a junior or senior, and said to me, confided in me in private, that they had experienced depression and they were so happy that, you know, I would share my story. And that's the biggest thing I tell people is that it's so hard to raise your hand to say, listen, I need help. But once you do, like the world, the weight is just lifted off your shoulders because, and that's the first step in anything. It could be, even if you're just a procrastinator, like paying bills or you're cleaning off that mountain of paperwork on your desk, you know, you think about it and the anxiety that leads up to it is greater than the event itself.
Yeah, that's so true. it's also, you know, when you're in that mode of feeling self-absorbed and feeling distressed by it all, the depression lies to you. It will tell you what good will come of talking about this. There is no hope. There is no change. And that's the sort of thing that you need to know about depression. It's in your mind. It feeds those lies. And in a way, the smarter you are, the more convinced you are of that as the truth in that moment. But it's not the truth. And you have to kind of almost prepare yourself for that. That's what will happen. That's the way, you know, depression manifests itself in lots of different ways, but that's a really common one. And you almost have to have your plan set in advance to say, I'm going to talk to this person because I know that they get it and I trust them. And you know, there's something called the safety plan where you actually think about these things in advance and you think about what are my triggers, who are the people I trust, and what are the activities that tend to kind of jumpstart my brain out of that mode, because there are those for most people that are really effective.
Great logic. I love it. And there's also the why me dialogue. And I told these kids yesterday, don't even bother with the why me, because I'll save you lots of time right now. I did the why me. Why is it happening to me? The reality is that's not going to change anything. The reality is you just have to ask for help and seek treatment. And don't even belabor and waste time on the why me, because the reality is you're predisposed or there's an event in your life that just triggered it. And that's what happened to me. I'm sure I'm predisposed. I'm predisposed to alcoholism. You know, you name it. I got a long list with the Farrell chain here. So, but the reality is it is what it is. And sometimes you can get stuck, you know, why me? Why did my boss doesn't like me? Why doesn't this girl or gentleman or whatever like me? But you have to deal with the current situation to move forward.
Yeah, it's true. But it is a process for each person. And they kind of, you know, I think the key thing, though, is when you tell your story, people see that you found a way to work through it, and they will, too, and to not get stuck in that kind of wallowing of the why me. Absolutely.
Tell us about the daunting, very, very powerful initiative AFSP has by the year 2025, correct?
Yes, we have set a bold goal to reduce the nation's suicide rate 20% by 2025. And if you paid attention to the media a few weeks ago when the CDC released their latest report, which used existing data but analyzed the last 15 years and showed that, unfortunately, the suicide rate has been trending up, and we've known that for the last, you know, 15, 16 years, but that in total it's gone up 24%. That is daunting. This is, you know, suicide is a major public health crisis in our country, and I think it's just now starting to get the attention that it deserves in terms of the level of mortality as well as the level of suffering. You know, you had mentioned earlier that there are lots of issues that lead up to a person's risk for ultimately in terms of suicide. But, you know, there's suicidal thinking, there's planning, there's attempts and behavior, and there's all the distress that comes along with that and for the families involved with those individuals. So we've known for some time, but again, I think, you know, policymakers and national leaders, state leaders, it's on the national agenda now in a way that, you know, I think we haven't seen before. So that bold goal is, you know, a big deal. It's auspicious. It's a bit daunting. But here's the thing. Science has shown us that there are ways to reduce the suicide rate, and we just haven't implemented those in any systematic or wide-scale way. So we know that that can happen.
In the CDC results, were there demographics breaking down the rise or decrease in certain areas?
Yes, absolutely. So what they found is, again, what we've seen for some time is that the most alarming trend is actually in the middle age sector of the American population. So it's men, and it's actually women too, from about age 45 to 64. And that group, specifically white men and white women, the suicide rate has gone up quite dramatically over that 15-16 year period. You know, for adolescents, it also has been going in the wrong direction, but not as dramatically as is the case for middle-aged Americans. And the one piece of good news in all of this is that for older-aged Americans, the rate has actually been trending downward. And I will say that's a demographic that we've been focused on with suicide prevention efforts for some time, and it's possible that some of those efforts are coming to bear, as well as, you know, suicide, of course, is very multifactorial in terms of what the drivers of a national suicide rate are. But with elderly Americans, that's the one silver lining that we hope continues to trend in the right direction.
Well, that's quite positive news, because with the gargantuan baby boomer generation growing,
that's right,
you know, to maximum capacity, that's good. So the fight is on the lower spectrum, the younger spectrum, between 45 to 50, and of course adolescents.
Yep, that's right. You know, you think about the middle-aged group there, and we're talking about a group of Americans mostly that are working Americans. And so it's just important to realize that, you know, in your workplace, there is every reason to believe that about 20% of your coworkers are probably struggling with some type of mental health condition at this time. And you can be the eyes and ears that help notice when mental health starts to deteriorate, and just be a kind, supportive, listening ear. And that can actually be a game changer for people, believe it or not. Of course, if you notice that in your own family, that's something really critically important that we all should be aware of. But I mean, even in our communities, even in our workplace, we can extend a caring hand and a listening ear and make a big difference, especially if we say, you know, I would respect you even more if you went and got some professional help for this. It sounds like you're really going through a lot. That kind of permission giving can be powerful.
My guest is Dr. Christine Motier, Chief Medical Officer at the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention. We're talking about the overnight walk that's happening in New York City this Saturday. You can still register, AFSP.org, AFSP.org, if you want to walk 16 miles myself and a couple of thousand other people. Dr. Motier, quick question for you. Sometimes you can't see the trees from the forest. So I always think, because sometimes, you know, I'm also a realist as well, but sometimes, you know, I'm a very optimistic person, half glass full type of person, that the stigma is being reduced more so than probably it is in my eyes, because obviously I'm encircled by people who are in the same movement, or I'm speaking to people who want to hear what I have to hear, et cetera. But do you think on a national level, I do believe we certainly have made progress. Is there any way to measure that?
Yes, actually. I mean, what I'll say first is I think even if it does, it has to start somewhere, right? And it usually starts with those who are personally affected and really passionate and take the time to get educated about these things. So that's okay. And then it tends to spread from there as long as there's energy and momentum. And I think that's actually what has been happening. To your question specifically, we partnered up with a couple other organizations and conducted a Harris poll of American adults a few months ago, and it was incredibly kind of positive and surprising. Over 90% of American adults say that mental health is as important to them as physical health, you know, meaning that era of kind of not understanding that mental health is even real because you can't see it, not as tangible as physical health, that we seem to be beyond that. I'm wondering now if people don't realize that their peers actually think that same way, because people still might feel a little hesitant, like maybe they'll be, you know, the outsider or stand out in some way if they speak out about these things. But the reality is the majority of people are recognizing this. It's also something like 89% of Americans believe that suicide is either mostly or somewhat preventable. And so that's a change, too, where people used to not really not understand that, again, that there are long-term and sort of upstream routes to suicide risk as well as that moment of crisis. So people are getting a better understanding of all of these things. And the main thing that they were even negative about in that poll was their sense that access to mental health care is still far from what it should be. And that was, again, that was the main kind of concern or complaint that came out.
Well, this is great news overall, because not only is our political system in major flux, which I'm great to speak about because, you know, it all needs to be shaken up, but even our perspective on mental illness is progressing.
Yes, it really is.
We only have another minute or so, but please talk to me about how exciting this event is. I mean, it's in a great event that pulls the community together. New York City, the Big Apple, what a great stage to have a 16-mile walk on through the island of New York City around the tip, across the Brooklyn Bridge. And I admitted before, I'm not sure if you were on hold back then, that I've actually never walked across the Brooklyn Bridge. But I mean, that's one of the things, like, people come from, you know, different continents just to do. Alone.
It's really true. It is, you know, it's kind of a historic event in the sense that the people who do our walks, whether it's the first time or whether they've done them before, they will talk about those moments as moments of change in their life. I mean, I think part of it is that empowerment of being with a couple thousand people who are just as passionate as you. And the conversations that get going as you're doing the walk, and you know this, it's like there are no reasons to keep secrets with this group. It's like the reason that you're there, people come right out with it. There's a bond that develops right away. And again, there's just a solidarity. And, you know, you should also know that these walks are some of the main ways that we are, as an organization, the leading private funder of suicide research and education and awareness raising in our nation. So it's making a difference, and each person makes a huge difference.
Oh, absolutely. I consider it my 18-mile therapy walk, because at the beginning of the show, I was talking about the bonds that you develop and what you just tell strangers. I mean, sometimes you tell strangers whatever you're doing in life, things that you wouldn't even tell other people. But of course, when you're on a platform where you share such a significant common bond, you know, it's just great. You know, it could be 3 o'clock in the morning. I remember when I did my walk, the first walk in 2002 in Washington, D.C., I remember being in the suburbs, just talking to a total stranger and just connecting on so many levels. And we were able to give and exchange different insights that really were just help us either, both of us and everyone, grow. It was amazing.
Absolutely. And I want to make sure your listeners know that people who do these walks are not just one type of person. It is everything under the sun, from people who simply care about these mm-hmm. issues, people who've been personally affected, either that they themselves have had struggles that have led them to consider or attempt suicide, or they might have lost a loved one to suicide, or they may just simply, again, care about the issue for a whole variety of either personal or professional reasons. So everyone is welcome at our walk.
And absolutely, we have to mention a very important point as well. People underneath the sun, we're talking about demographically as well.
That's right.
Gender-wise, age-wise, I believe you have to be, I think, 14 or 15 with a guardian or parent. But, I mean, it runs families, colleagues, you name it. They form teams and they make these great T-shirts. My sister, Nancy Farrell, who obviously you know, who's on the board of AFSP, made great T-shirts with my brother's picture on it in 2007 when we did a former New York City walk for AFSP overnight walk, and it was incredible. And it's just a great way to show the reason and, more importantly, to bring to the present why you're there. And very quickly,
absolutely.
I have to let you go because we're out of time. But did you hear of this incredible person who's walking across New Jersey, towing a casket to raise awareness on mental illness, Greta Schwartz?
I didn't until I heard it on your show.
It's incredible. Our producers are still trying to get her on a show because I know she's getting to Trenton in the next couple hours, and we're going to keep tabs on her, but we're going to talk about her. And lastly, Dr. Motir, I'm going to be talking to so many people during the walk, and I'm going to have recordings that I'm going to share with our listeners next week. Some great intimate conversations that are going to be shared from people about why they're walking and what they hope to benefit by this in terms of seeing change.
That is so fantastic. And for anyone who's interested in checking it out or coming even last minute, the website is theovernight.org.
Theovernight.org. Dr. Christine Motir, thank you as usual. And next time, I'm going to hold you to it. You're going to come to my studio.
You got it, Mark. It sounds great.
I'll see you on the Intrepid.
All right.
Take care. The show is Insight. My name is Mark Farrell. Thank you so much for listening. Of course, this and every Thursday. My next guest is no stranger to the show. She's a friend of the show. Her name is Melissa Penn. She was here a couple weeks ago with her husband and co-founder, Adam Stengel. They founded Happy Fest, which is a great organization, an event that took place in Raceway Park, New Jersey, and it was a obstacle course for people of all disabilities and abilities. And guess what? You would think in the wake of a Happy Fest event that I'm sure took a year or so to plan, she would be sitting by a pool somewhere. But no, she has something in her body that won't let her sit still. She has put on another walk that she's been doing for many, many years. Actually, the Happy Fest event was the accumulation of that and realizing that more needs to be done. And she has created a hemophilia walk. Hello, Melissa Penn, and welcome back.
Hey, Mark. Thank you for having us again.
I feel like we were just at Happy Fest a few hours ago.
Listen, you were great at Happy Fest. Mark was our host, and
it was a great day. It was a great event. As a matter of fact, let's just quickly talk about their turnout. The turnout was great. The obstacles were great around an actual racetrack, a car racetrack, that were very, very incredible. As a matter of fact, each obstacle had alternates for people of different abilities, ages. It was just incredible. And what I love the most and what went over really, really well was at the end you had this great, great finish line with, I don't know, an ocean of bubbles that people came running through and wheelchairs would come blasting through and arms raised, and it was just a movie moment.
The end was so spectacular because everybody was happy. And it did not matter whether they were running, whether they were a year and a half old, whether they came in a wheelchair or a walker or however they went through it. They were happy, and they were happy to be together. It was an awesome moment.
And very quickly, we would be remiss in not talking about Ronnie Brooks. Ronnie Brooks is a gentleman I saw about a year or so ago when we were talking about what you were going to be doing with the Happy Fest. I said, you have to get Ron Brooks to sing your national anthem. A disabled singer who does this on his own time, volunteers, and was incredible.
Ronnie Brooks he gives you chills. It's hard not to cry when you hear him sing. He's the best national anthem singer I have ever heard. And he is a double amputee, and he gets up there and he sings his heart out, and it's so meaningful to him. He comes dressed in his suit and he puts his all into it. And he also was so excited to be there for Happy Fest and to be celebrating people of all abilities. It was a great moment when Ronnie sang.
So it certainly was, and it still resonates in my body. I got chills just even thinking about it. So just as the obstacles are just recently put away, you are taking your sneakers out for the Hemophilia Walk happening this Sunday, June 5th, right here in New York City at Riverside Park, New York City. And tell me the genesis of this, please.
So in 2006, my family started a walk in Riverside Park. And at that time, our son was in pre-K, and he has hemophilia, which means that his blood does not clot properly, and he's missing a protein in his blood, factor VIII. And that actually does not cause external bleeding like a lot of people think. And really, before I had a kid with hemophilia, I also thought paper cut bleed to death,
wow.
which is not what hemophilia is. Hemophilia is internal bleeding, and you can bleed in any muscle, any joint, or any organ. And
yeah, it's a common misnomer.
It is. And, of course, how would you know it? There aren't mm-hmm. a lot of people with hemophilia, and we weren't doing any hemophilia walks back then. So hemophilia is actually treated by clotting factor, and my son is able to get what he's missing. He takes it intravenously in his vein every single day. And, in fact, the medicine that he takes every single day costs $3,000 a day. So he spends well over $1 million a day. Some kids don't use as much. Maybe they do it every other day. But it's
that
incredibly, incredibly expensive.
Inconceivable.
And we are just blessed that we live in the United States and that we
and
can get
healthcare.
Medicine and have health insurance, because in 75% of the world, they are getting either no or very little treatment, and the kids there lead very painful lives, and they typically will die by 24.
I can't gloss over this fact, the cost of the medicine. Is it because, well, we probably all know why it costs so much, because the lack of other options, because it still has a patent, correct?
No, I absolutely would not go blaming the pharmaceuticals. It is a very difficult process to make factor.
Really?
It is extraordinarily difficult, and I feel very lucky that they're actually putting their money into the proper facilities to make safe factor, because years ago, when the blood supply was not safe, people with hemophilia bore the brunt of that issue, and 90% of the population became HIV positive, and almost 100% of the people born before 1990 got hep C. So to make safe, effective factor is extremely, extremely difficult and extremely expensive. And so we're grateful that the pharmaceuticals still continue to make factor when the numbers are not huge of people who need it.
Do you have don't mean to put you on the spot here, Melissa, but is there a percentage of people who actually have hemophilia?
Yes. So hemophilia it hits all demographics equally. It is one in 5,000 male births. And they say one in 5,000 male births, but the reality is that women can get hemophilia too. It's much more uncommon, but we certainly know several wonderful women who are going to be with us at the walk on Sunday who have severe hemophilia as well.
And what was the first sign that your son had hemophilia?
His heel stick did not stop bleeding when he was born.
So the doctors were aware of it right away.
It took a couple of weeks of consistent bleeding mm-hmm. for them to test him, and then the results came back quickly.
So, as new parents, this is your first child, correct?
Yes.
You must have been completely thrown back and confused, and thinking, "Oh my God, what did we do wrong? Is it my fault?" But realizing how much information this was, how many years ago? 14 years ago.
So my son is 14. He was born in 2001. As a new parent and as a first-time parent. Absolutely devastating. You don't know what it means. You don't know if your kid is going to, like, can you put your kid in a car? Why is your kid going to have a bleed? I mean, and at that point, now as people get older, they typically take this clotting factor on a preventative basis. But when they're little, they take it only when they're bleeding. So, yeah, it was terrifying. I didn't know if I was going to recognize bleeds. I thought that I was going to cry every single time he needed to be infused.
Sure.
And, you know, of course, I stopped crying by probably number four or five.
Well, because all your energies are put towards greater goods in terms of walks, spreading information, raising critical funds, et cetera.
So when Zach was finishing pre-K, we really didn't know anybody in the community. I had one friend. And we decided to do a walk in Riverside Park. And at that point, we were going to do a walk just so that the kids that age could understand that they were doing something to help somebody else. They were young. They were.
It's a great lesson in life.
And the whole nursery school came out. There were probably about 200 people. And there were just a couple of families with bleeding disorders that we knew. And then it grew. And then we made it a 5K as well. And then by the time we did the third walk, it became a national walk. And we started getting more and more people from the community. So as time went on, the community grew as the walk grew. And then people started bringing their friends and family. And here we are in 2016. And we typically get around 1,500 people. It's taking place in 40 cities across the country.
40 cities. What you started right here in New York City.
That's right. And so if people can join us, the original walk.
The original. No imitation here.
Hemophilia walk is our New York City walk. It is in Riverside Park this Sunday. The walk starts at 10 a.m. Check-in is at 9 a.m. You can register online at nyhemophilia.org. You can register and or donate online. And, of course, you can register the day of, too, although it's a little faster if you register online. And everybody that comes and donates will get a T-shirt. All the kids get a tie-dye T-shirt, which is a thing. Everybody who's been there for years, they collect their different tie-dyes. Kids love it. They wear it all year.
Awesome.
They get a medal. And you do the 1 mile or you do a 5K and you come back and there's these awesome booths which are giving out.
Then there's an obstacle course. Oh, no, wrong event.
But there's ice pops, there may be cotton candy and some other surprises, some goodies. And the reality is you cannot go wrong spending a Sunday in Riverside Park. It's so much fun. It's also relatively quick, so then you can go do something
sure.
else, go to the boat
Doesn't
base
take
and
up
hang
your whole
out.
Day. Sure.
But it's really breathtaking, I have to say, for somebody in the bleeding disorder community, when we are a small community and you get there and you see all those people, you see a sea of people
collectively coming together for the same good.
And it is
that's empowering.
It's empowering. And I have to say, it's something that my son is really very proud of. And I think a lot of the kids and the families in the communities are in the community are really proud of it. And it has also given us the opportunity to open up conversation with other people who we may not have been comfortable with, whether it's coworkers
sure.
or classmates. It's been a great vehicle for raising awareness
and, hard to
and
deny.
Building community.
I mean, does Zach community. Understand the significance and the gargantuan capacity that one walk that you created, you can't say in his honor, but for hemophilia and obviously to benefit your son, has grown to 40 states and has possibly changed the trajectory of hemophilia?
I think, yeah, he's tremendously proud. The name of his team is actually Zachophilia. So you would think, when somebody came up with it, I thought he wouldn't want that, you know, combining Zach and hemophilia. But actually, he's really proud of it. So he thought Zachophilia was funny and awesome. And Zachophilia, the first team. So, yes, he is proud of what was inspired by him.
Now, I wouldn't be doing my job if I didn't pause to state the obvious that you and your husband, Adam Stengel, have created two platforms, two movements that have and will continue to create change. And a lot of people certainly do great in this world, parents, people who are single, but to have such an extraordinary passion to not only maybe donate money, which is a great thing to do, and people donate their time, but the actual create events is a whole nother, you know, crazy species and time, countless amount of hours and money and energy. I just take my hat off to you, but if you can sum it up, why and how you do it, I'm sure people really want to know why.
You know, I really appreciate that. I really do. I think for a lot of these things, at some point, a good idea has its own energy and it has its own momentum. But, you know, for me, I do feel like, you know, what's the point of being here on this earth? I do want it to be a little bit different when I'm gone. But I also, this is clearly not just us. It's an idea that people have taken and built on. And when you see these teams getting together that raise $30,000, that bring 200 people, it's beautiful. And that
empowers you, of course.
That
you and Adam.
Is great. So they have taken what is just an idea and they have made it their own. And that's how it gets the energy to keep on going. And that is
and
such a cool
you.
Thing to say, to see. It's a very awesome thing to see.
Again, that's this Sunday, Riverside Park, which is a beautiful park. Central Park has its own beauty. Riverside Park also has its own beauty.
Absolutely. It's along the water. You can see the boats. You feel like you're on vacation.
And you get a breeze usually.
Yeah.
Which is nice. And anybody can get out there and do a mile or 5 miles or simply donate. Or do you need volunteers? I'm sure you always need volunteers.
If people are interested in volunteering, get in touch with us through that website, nyhemophilia.org.
So anything slated, any kind of next event or cause you're going to be starting an event for?
You know, I have to say, we're so thrilled with the fact that the Hemophilia Walk has been a really positive unifying force in this community that was sort of fractured for a while. And to see the young families finding us early, which is not something that I had even, and to see the older guys who have been quite isolated coming back for the first time and sort of feeling their way, and the walk being a vehicle for them to do that is really awesome. So that's where we're at. We're really happy where it's at.
Well, if Melissa Penn and Adam Stengel have anything to say about it, they're going to do some change and continue to do good as you have been doing for years. And I thank you so much for doing the Happy Fest event and, of course, the Hemophilia Walk. And I also want to mention in the theme of walks today, thank you to Dr. Christine Motier from the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, the Out of the Darkness Overnight Walk. And if you get a chance, please Google Greta Schwartz's name, Greta Schwartz, who's walking multiple miles, 80 miles across the new state of New Jersey, ending in a few hours at the Capitol, Trenton, to further promote mental health. And she is towing a casket. That's right, a casket. My name is Mark Farrell. I had a great show. Always great hanging out with you. See you next Thursday. Insight is over, always available on PRN.FM, show archives and more. And check me out if you'd like to have me speak at your school organization, MarkFarrellMotivation.com. Ciao.